Welcome to Start Writing. I'm Joe Bendosky, and today my guest is Lee Isserow. He is the author of the book we're discussing, which is Touch Sensitive. He's an award-winning screenwriter and filmmaker with over 15 years experience in the industry. He actually switched over to writing novels because he'd moved kind of into making commercials, and he had all these stories he still wanted to tell, and so that's kind of how he shifted into the genre. He is hybrid, most of his books being published indie, but he has gone with Kindle Scout Press for his latest book, which has given him some more exposure that way. And so here is the interview. So Lee, for the audience, why don't you talk a little bit about the hook and the premise of your book and kind of your target audience there?
Okay. Well, Touch Sensitive is about a detective with a condition, sensitivity. He absorbs the memories of whatever or whoever he touches. And then when the cops call him in on a case, a gruesome artistic murder that only someone with his gift can solve, he finds himself having his life spiral out of control and forced to cross every line, betray everyone who trusts him, because the murderer of this guy is sensitive, just like him.
Yeah, I think just kind of a little explanation there. So I think you mentioned, like, he absorbs the memory. So if he touches any person, he knows their entire life history in a moment. And the murderer he's chasing knows how that works and has distinctly carved up the victim so that he cannot use that ability to figure out how the murder happened.
Yeah, I mean, he gets, like, can pick up traces of it, but can't actually remember the murder as it occurred. And that kind of sparks his curiosity and sets him on this trail to find out who the killer is.
Yeah, and so one of the things I loved about your novel, and I haven't read your other books, so I don't know if this is your style or just how you approached here, but interiority, like so much of the book is just inside this guy's head. And like I think I mentioned in one of our emails, like I think it would be exhausting to write that way, because when I try to write that interiority, I can get, you know, maybe a paragraph out and then I kind of have to leap to the next action. But you dig in and you go for pages. So talk to me a little about your process there and how you approach that writing style.
I don't know. It felt kind of very natural for what it was, like for how that style came about. I think it's it's inspired to some degree by Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale, where pretty much everything that happens is in that character's head. And not only do you get to understand the world from her perspective, but from her past before that. So that's kind of the way that I think I came into this book. Kind of, it was always going to be one man's search for the truth, to discover more about himself by solving this murder. So I think it was an organic process. I haven't really done that with any other book.
Really? That's interesting. Yeah. So how was the writing process? Did you find it difficult to write this way, or it just kind of flowed?
I mean, to be honest, it flowed a lot, but mostly because the character is very much me. He's so broken and damaged and is self-aware of that and aware that he smokes and drinks too much. It was just totally a natural process and kind of wrote itself to some degree. I mean, I think the plotting of it, the breaking the story down, took longer to kind of work it out more than the writing itself, which is is a weird thing. But it literally, I think I wrote it in maybe 10 or 12 days or something.
Are you kidding me? 10 or 12 days. That's ridiculous. Were you on vacation? You're just like, I'm going to take a writing vacation and just write all day?
No, essentially, it's, I've stopped doing my actual job these days. So it was literally just kind of sitting down, going from one cafe to the next for a couple of hours, writing, I think, around 10, maybe 12,000 words a day. It just kind of happened. And suddenly I look back at it and go, wow, that's a lot of writing. I'm lucky if I get like 5,000 out on a good day.
Yeah, that is a really intense period. So you're writing full time now, I take it? I mean, I've seen you've got several books out.
Yeah, pretty much releasing a book a month these days. In fact, more than I think as the year progresses, as May comes even, there's going to be 2 books a month coming out, which is a little bit crazy.
That's a little bit crazy. I'll agree with you. So I'm gonna circle back around to the writing style. Like I said, I haven't read your other books. But one of the reasons I really wanted to talk about the interiority in this book specifically is because I feel like in each storytelling medium, there is a strength we have that none of the others have. Like when you talk about like visuals and explosions and different things like that, you can't compete with movies and television. And when it comes to television, you cannot compete with the length of their storylines. You know, I mean, they'll go 10 years putting out 20 episodes a year. I mean, when you have a long story to tell, you can't compete with that. But when it comes to getting inside the character's head, books are really the only place that works. And I feel like you've just done it so well in this book that I usually try to find authors that I interview where I can look at their book and be like, you are doing that better than I've seen it done by anyone else. And that's how I feel about the interiority in this book, is that it's something that authors should really look at and study and be like, how is he getting that deep in the character's head, and how is he approaching that? And so I really love that about the novel, and it's definitely something I recommend for that element.
I mean, it's interesting that you say that, you compared or the contrast the differences between books and television, because obviously I have a film and television background, and still, like, despite this being touch sensitive specifically, being so inside the character's head, there are still people like reviewers and the like that say that it feels cinematic, which is curious, like compared to the other books that I've written that are more intentionally cinematic. But even like pretty much every book that I put out, it has at one point been pitched in one way or another as, say, television or movies, and I've just kind of been recycling and going back to the well and putting them in on the page instead of on the screen.
That is an interesting dynamic there. Okay, so let's dig into craft a little bit more here. So what do you consider the strongest part of your writing, and how did you develop it? Like, if you were to teach that to someone, how would you approach that?
I think it would be breaking story, because I mean, that's my background, like sitting in writers' rooms or sitting around and pitching concepts and getting them down to the bare bones and understanding why and how a story progresses and making it feel as natural as possible, and organic, I guess. And that's probably the strength that I've kind of carried with me for the last, 20 years of doing film things and now doing books.
So writer's room, that's a TV and film reference there. So talk to me about like what happens in the writer's room specifically that helps you understand and break it down so well.
Well, essentially, concepts are pitched for where the plot can be taken, and from there, between the various people around, other ideas are thrown in, whether it's character moves or experiences or so on. And so, I essentially, as an author now, have become a one-man writing room, I guess. So letting different voices in my head kind of speak out and push one way or another. I don't know. It's a little bit insane the way that I work, because it is there's a lot of talking out loud,
I think
talking to
every writer
myself.
does
And
that.
I mean, yeah, I don't know how many writers go into cafes and quite happily talk to themselves, but yeah, it's better as a solitary kind of in your house by yourself kind of thing, that I haven't really developed that aspect of it yet.
So, yeah, well, I know myself, I do a lot of talking out loud, and every once in a while, like I'll be out for a run and, just talking to myself, working through a dialogue or whatever, and someone will come across me and I think they give me funny looks. They're like, "Who are you talking to?" But I think that's just how writers are. Or I'll have a roommate come home and they'll see me just pacing the living room talking, and I'm not on the phone. I'm just talking to myself, working out something in the book. So I think it's very much a writer's thing, is that at some point you need to talk it out and hear it. So what is an element of craft that you're currently focusing and developing on now, and how are you approaching that?
That I'm not sure of. I think it's always about developing different worlds for the books. I mean, that's something that some reviewers that have, you know, gone through from one book to another have said, is that each of the books feels like they're different, and that's intentional to some degree. It's like whether it's in vocabulary or it's sentence structure and things, it's always something that I'm working on to make sure that each series has its own language, I guess.
So is this one part of a series, or is it a standalone at the moment?
At the moment, it's standalone because it's big, and also it's released through Kindle Press, so I don't feel like I can just kind of rock up to them and go, okay, so I've got another six of these. How do you feel about dropping them? I literally do have another six vaguely planned, but I haven't started writing them because I'm busy launching another series soon.
You are prolific, man, cranking out stuff like this. Well, I guess two books a month is insanely ambitious. Like, I look at the authors who knock out a book a month, and I think that's unreal, you know, whereas my own process is much slower. So tell me about why the divergence from the film industry. You know, you were writing in film and television, and then you've switched over novels. What was the catalyst there? I know my own experience was hearing the phrase, make this scene cheaper, drove me nuts.
I mean, a lot of it was, I think, because the amount that I wrote and pitched compared to what actually got picked up is so infinitesimal. It's like it's barely a percent of all the stuff that I've written over the years. And writing novels is, you know, that there is no EP hanging over your head and exec producer sitting there going, yeah, okay, so we kind of like it, but could you make everything slightly greener? And, you know, there's so much freedom with books, and that's something that I've always kind of wanted to do, but I've been putting it off and putting it off. And then also I didn't like the person that television made me. I think that it is such an ego's game, and I've become like so much more humble through writing, through actually having interaction with one's audience, which you don't get in that field. Because, you know, and there's something just so magical about being able to actually, not only the reviews, but to actually have a one-on-one email relationship with people that are reading and enjoying your books. And that's just turned everything around for me. I've enjoyed writing 1,000 times more through switching over to prose.
Huh. Well, that's good to hear. That's really good to hear. That's cool. So what made you start though? Were you just like, you know, you walked home from work one day, it was like, I was like, this is a good idea, regardless of what they think, I'm going to write the book so no one can say no?
No, it was more like I switched over to working on commercials. This was literally only last year. And yeah, I was just kind of looking at the work that we were getting in, it wasn't even narrative anymore. I was just kind of sitting around with all these stories in my head that I couldn't get out, because there is no place for narrative in the commercial world, really. So I just kind of sat down and started doing it and went, oh, God, this is, like, in comparison to pitching and then doing an outline and a treatment and then eventually writing a script. Like, literally, I can just get this story out. And it kind of snowballed from there, because one was so, no, I don't want to say easy, but it was straightforward. And then I said, okay, so I've done this one. Why don't we move on to the next one? And just it kept going. Within, like, I believe, like, 1 or 2 months, I already had, like, 3 or 4 books. And they were shorter at that time. They were only, like, 30, 40,000 words. And now, obviously, I'm, you know, most of the books that I have now are somewhere between 50 and 90. Yeah, it's just so much fun, and it doesn't feel like a job, because it is just, you know, exorcising these story demons that have been floating around my head for so long. So yeah, it's I don't know. I get giddy just thinking about how much fun I'm having.
That's great. That's great. So you mentioned this book is through Kindle Press. So talk to me about your publishing. That kind of confused me. So are you a hybrid? Are you part press, part indie? Like, what's your publishing model?
I think technically it's hybrid. Because most of my work is obviously indie, and then that book went through the Kindle Scout process, and they picked that up. Whether they'll pick up any of the others in future, who knows? I think their process is somewhat I don't know. Within the Kindle Scout community, none of us really understand how we ended up where we are, like, being published by them, because there'll be some people that got, you know, were hot and trending, like, for, you know, the entire run of the 30 days, and other of us, you know, got maybe a couple of days here and there, and so it's a mysterious process, and I imagine it's based on what they think the market is ready for at the time. So who knows if you know, I'll ever get to do another book through them again, but yeah, it was a great experience just being a part of it.
So why did you choose to go through Scout with this book as opposed to just staying with your indie model?
I think it was a story that I wanted to get to a wider audience if possible. Like, I had shopped it around to agents and publishers, and they took a look at it and went, "It takes in place entirely in his head? That's a little weird." And Scout somehow just kind of saw through that or read past the initial chapters of it just being his thought process. So I don't know. I don't think it would have got the numbers it has done if I'd self-published it, because obviously they have a marketing reach and so forth that right. That the average indie doesn't really get to take advantage of.
So talk to me about, like, your own marketing. I mean, so you've gone full-time writer, so you must be doing fairly well. Talk to me about the beginning, when you first started out with that first book, and how you've progressed from there.
I mean, I don't know if I'm doing fairly well. I've just kind of decided to pack other work in and just kind of, you know, I'll keep going until the money runs out, and then I'll go knock on some doors and say, "Hey, do you need anything written?" But yeah, so I mean, initially, I had read all the blogs and picked up all the advice that everyone knows at this point. And it's only, I guess, this year where there's actually been any kind of proper movement. Like, the first year I spent kind of shilling, I think, 2, 3, maybe 5 copies a month if I was lucky. And this year it's just turned around completely. And I don't know whether that's switching from mostly standalone books to series, or whether it's more that I have that first year of kind of building up interaction and kind of personality with the audience. Because the mailing list is it took me 6 months to actually kind of get around to a mailing list, and then another 6 months to actually start jumping on Insta Freebie and the like to kind of build that up and start getting a dialogue with people that are reading the books. So yeah, I think it's been like slow, and I don't think it would have happened any other way. I mean, slow is relative, given it's, you know, I've been doing this for 15 months or whatever. But yeah, it's, I don't know, it feels very organic in how it's happened. And I don't know if ads make a difference. I'm still trying to work out what is working and what isn't. But I think the newsletter thing is like, seriously, like the key point of anyone hearing about the books and buying them eventually.
Right. So talk to me about building the newsletter with only one book, or I guess, did you have several out by the time you got around to it? Because you said you were 6 months in.
Yeah, so there were several books out, and I think, you know, There's front matter and back matter in all the books saying, if you like this, come say hello. I spend 2 hours a night answering your emails.
Yeah, that sounds miserable.
Oh no, it's wonderful though. Again, like I said, it just gets me giddy. Just kind of having that interactivity with people that like what you do. It's such a wonderful thing. So I don't know. I think it happened like it's after 6 months. It started kind of people started trickling in, but then things like newsletter swaps and Insta freebie have totally turned that around and made it. You know, instead of a list of a couple of hundred or whatever, now it's 4,000, 5,000 or something. And they, you know, people come and go depending on how much I get distracted along the way. Like they know far too much about me. The people on my mailing list, they know that I have trouble getting clothes because I've got a 26 inch waist and things like that. Like it's, yeah. But I think there's a large portion of people that like being that knowing an author that intimately.
So as far as audience engagement, I could just mostly email, or do you use other platforms like Facebook and Twitter and whatnot?
I mean, I'm on Facebook, but I don't really feel like it's I hear and speak to authors all the time that say that their interactivity on Facebook goes a long way to building an audience. I don't really feel that so much, but maybe that's just because I really don't like Facebook. But I'm on Twitter, and again, that's not really, it doesn't feel like it's an author's medium so much. I mostly use it to post jokes that I don't have anywhere else to put.
Yeah, so it's funny.
Yeah, it's like it's been has it been 10 years of Twitter? It's been like 10 years of just kind of going, okay, I have a joke, but I can't put it in a script, and it's going to get me fired from another job. So, yeah, let's just put it on Twitter. No one will notice.
No one will notice. That's awesome. So when I was checking out your Amazon site, I noticed you have a lot of book trailers. Have you found that they've been helpful? Or, like, I feel like the industry, depending on what year you read about book trailers, sometimes they're like, they're great and they really help. And other times they're like, it's a waste of money. Don't do it. Nobody watches them. So what's your own experience there?
Who you are with that? Because like, oh God, which was a really great book trailer. I think, David Wong for, this book is full of spiders. There was a trailer for that, and it's cinematic and it's beautiful and it's chilling and funny, and it's got all those things that the tone of the book is in the trailer, and I think that comes across really well. But then a lot of trailers are just montages of images and things. The way that I've gone with it is because obviously I have this quote-unquote cinematic background, is that I've gone for cinematic trailers because they are in the basest form, the books are all movies on the page to some degree. So I've taken kind of the, you know, experience and knowledge that I have with film and kind of gone, okay, let's get a crew together. Let's go out and film 6 trailers in a day because they're straightforward and I have actors lying around. So I don't know if they help in any way, but I think it's nice to have content. So whether that's, you know, to go on the Facebook or the website or whatever, it's, you know, it feels like it's more of an experience, I think. I mean, I also do soundtracks for every book because, again, it's part of the cinematic experience. So if you want to read the book whilst hearing the song that will be playing in the background as you watch it, There's a soundtrack. I don't think anyone listens to them, but I enjoy it as a way to waste like an hour or two of a day just kind of going, okay, so we're in this point of the plot, so it should be, oh, an action-packed track full of excitement and adventure, and then, oh, we're in a lazy jazz kind of mood, and so on.
That's interesting because, like, I've had discussions with friends who work both film and in novel writing, and one of the things we've talked about is that, you know, as much as there's a lot of strength to the visual elements of film, we always say the thing they really have on us is the background music, right? Like, you can invoke so much emotion with music, and we don't have that unless you've got an audiobook that's using a soundtrack.
Hmm. Although I don't think I've heard any audiobooks that actually have a soundtrack to them.
I've
heard things that are more like radio plays, maybe, but an actual soundtrack, I haven't really...
Is it? I think I checked out... I can't even remember the name of the book. It was a David I can't remember his name. He's really big, and it's like Baldisi or something like that. And his had some background music, but it also had a lot of like sound effects, which I actually didn't care for in the audio. But I think audiobooks are really popular these days. So I think we're going to see the industry maybe not evolve, but at least testing a lot of different things to improve the quality of the experience.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, was it The World War Z audiobook where it was like a radio play and you had like a whole host of different actors doing the different parts rather than, you know, the one person changing their voice for each role. And yeah, it's definitely, I think I really like the radio play vibe of audiobooks, but you know, that means getting a whole cast together in a recording booth is a lot of effort.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, that's something that the big publishers can afford to do.
Yeah. I think, you know, 10 years ago, we first started to see, like, in those third-person viewpoints, you'd get, if it was a male POV, you'd get the male narrator and then a female. But now, there's definitely several audiobooks I've listened to where, if it's female dialogue, the female narrator comes in. Well, then why don't you tell us where to find you, maybe what your latest project is, if something new's come out after Touch Sensitive, and all those details.
Okay. At the moment, I'm halfway through releasing a four-book serial called In the Blood, and that is out on Amazon. It's coming out once a month, so there's another 2 months left of that. And then in, I think, the middle of May, I've got a new series kicking off, an urban fantasy detective thing called The Freelancers, which is coming out then. I mean, there's, you know, the rest of the year's worth of books, but I can't remember them off the top of my head. I'm on Twitter at Lee_Isero. That's ISSERO. And the website for all the book things with the trailers and soundtracks and things that no one ever listens to is abam.info. That's abam.info. And yeah, that's me.
So, all right. That's great. And then I believe we do have an audio sample that we'll play at the end of the podcast for Touch Sensitive, right?
Yeah.
So is that just random clippings or will it be like chapter one, chapter two? What are we looking at here?
It'll be the first couple of chapters, I guess.
Okay.
Because, I've got the audiobook already recorded. It's just waiting on Kindle Press.
So great. Are you the narrator for the audiobook? I called in and I heard your voice, I was like, that is exactly what I imagine the main character of Touch Sensitive to sound like. That is exactly it.
Yeah, I am. So. I do all the audiobooks, and that's, you know, getting to pretend that I'm a voiceover artist like I have done various points over the last 20 years.
Well, this was great, man. Thanks. Thank you for your time. Yeah, that's it. Thank you for your time.
Awesome. Thank you. I'll email the audiobook bits over to you just now.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. And I can just, as soon as I edit this thing, I can tack that on the end there. And hopefully you'll get a little bump from the sales there. I actually have no idea. I never hear back from anyone of the impact of the podcast. So I think my audience is very diverse, though, because I'm targeted at writers as opposed to any specific genre.
Yeah.
So, but I do try to pick, I don't know if I say authors, but I pick a book of an author where I feel like they have done at least one element of writing better or as good as I've seen anywhere else. So, and whatnot. So, all right. We will, I guess, maybe catch you later or at least email you. So,
yeah, fantastic. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. That was our interview with Lee Isero and talking about his book, Touch Sensitive. You can find him on Amazon. He has a lot of books that are free, so you can kind of check him out if you're interested. We did mention that the thing that I love the most about Touch Sensitive is kind of unique to that book, and I really do recommend checking it out, particularly if you're struggling with what interiority is, or just improving your own style on that. It was really well done in that book. As always, if you enjoy the show, leave us a review. We would love and that and help people spread the word. If you go to Jay Bendosky on Twitter, we put out our tweets, and if you could retweet some of the tweets about the show, that would be great, or comment on them. And if you want to support us, check out one of our books, Travis's or Mine, Travis's Song of Locke. You can actually get the first half of the book for free, so you can really check it out, see if it's your kind of story. It's a high fantasy. And you can check out my book, When the Sky Falls. There's actually several books by that title, so make sure you check the author name as well, Joseph Bendosky. And as always, thanks for listening.
Chapter 1. Ever since I discovered my sensitivity, shit has done its very best to turn up on my doorstep. Today's shit is a missing girl. But rather than doing anything practical to track her down, I'm stuck here, waiting. Waiting is the majority of the job. I've become a little too good at it. Sitting or standing just out of view, sometimes in plain sight. The key is to think yourself invisible, passive enough to be ignored. Inconspicuous, nonchalant. You get good at word games and coming up with synonyms when most days are nothing but killing time. Without them, all this loitering isn't great for one's sanity. The mind wanders whilst the body lies fallow. I'm sat on a lone wooden bench, inexplicably placed on a small patch of suburban wasteland. There used to be grass and trees here. A visual respite from the surrounding buildings, hiding behind a knee-high red brick wall. Sometime recently, the council had some money to burn, an underspend that needed to be overspent. They ripped up the grass, shifted a few trees, and dumped tarmac down to make a path. A slim island of grass still remains, a few feet wide by maybe 10 foot long. But it looks like someone clumsy took a sledgehammer to the wall, letting the path meet the street. Not that much money to waste, obviously, or they would have made it all pretty. Maybe these days, this is the city equivalent of woodland. A dogshit-stained oasis. A little bit of green to relax the eyes from the monotopian greys and browns that lie beyond its borders. I'm loitering just off a nice street, South Bedford. They call this the Georgian Quarter, and if the facades were more cared for, they'd probably feel illustrious, affluent, erudite. But the house I'm staring at hasn't been painted for years. Brickwork cracking, paint peeling from the door and window frames. No longer are these the million-pound houses fit for a wealthy family. They've long since been broken up into apartments, as many as can be shoved into the weary, flayed skin of once great buildings. Rooms constructed of thin, plasterboard walls, a former magnificent sitting room turned into an open-plan lounge and kitchen, two-bed and bath. That's how we live these days, either sharing a fraction of a relic from a bygone era, or in a newly constructed cube that lacks anything close to character or charisma. A soulless void with some IKEA trimmings to make it something close to habitable. Desmond Morris knew this was coming, that Western society was building itself a zoo. He saw the isolation epidemic decades before it had a hashtag Spotify ads and a support line. This level of isolation is an amorphous beast. Thriving off dark thoughts, growing in the crevices of the subconscious, spreading roots through the unobserved backward swamps of neural tissue, laying foundations of loneliness with a mighty thicket of demonic foliage, stretching contorted vines, night-blooming flowers blossoming from thorny black stems. Sickly putrefied pollen of despondence carried on the gentle breeze of absent-minded thoughts, whisked on a forlorn wind of half-remembered nightmares. A weakened mind is prone to an allergic reaction, an assimilation of those twisted, sorrowful notions as one's own. Knowing that those crippling, chronic, paralyzing feelings of dejection aren't your own don't make it any better. There's no easy or quick fix, not if you don't have a support system or the faculties to escape a self-destructive mindscape. You start to become invisible, disappear in plain sight. To catch eye contact from a stranger gets the paranoia bubbling. Why would they be looking at me? Another smoke will clear the air, figuratively at least. Sitting in one place for too long can be mad-making. A casual observation becomes a rant, becomes a deconstruction, all presented in a soliloquy to an audience of one that already knows the lines, reading from the same damn page. Therapy was not helpful. It encouraged this, if anything. I've been here for close to 2 hours. If patience is a virtue, what does that make waiting? The path to equanimity? An off-ramp for the potentially virtuous? 11 cigarette butts lie at my feet. The 12th soon to join them. Normal people have watches. I have smoking as my sundial. Cancer as my co-pilot. I know I should stop, but at 32 I've been smoking for more years than I haven't. It's part of who I am, etched into my bones, the grain in the wood. And if I stopped, how would I get through all this waiting? Other PIs have a healthy podcast addiction, but the only ones I listen to tend to result in laughter. And a guy giggling to himself doesn't make great for inconspicuous. Plus, I gotta keep my head in the game. He intended to return in 20 to 30 minutes. That was a half hour or so before I got here. Junkies can't keep time for shit, unless it's for their appointment at the dole office. That's unfair. A broad statement. I should appreciate a day sitting outside in the sun, right? Even if I can only glimpse it through the canopy of leaves above. Be happy that it's not gray or cold or raining. But there's a girl missing. Every second could count, and I've wasted 7,200 seconds sitting here waiting for the shitbag to get back. I think about moving, going back to his door, getting another read on it. Maybe I missed something. Maybe he left a memory of where he was going. People do that when they're thinking clearly. Unfortunately, his mind was a thick opiate sludge. Like trying to find a needle in a rotting, pulsating, oozing haystack of disjointed thoughts, decisions, intents. Sense memories seen through a fog of drug-seeking aimlessness and distraction. I don't know how these people function. 15 minutes becoming 2 hours. Time stretched, contorted. Every second elongated beyond recognition. There's probably a Nobel Prize waiting in the wings for whoever figures out the correlation between junkie time and normal time. If only the building didn't have a key fob entry, a magnetic lock on the door, I could have been in and out by now, an hour and a half closer to finding her. Need to learn about RFID frequencies, work out how to hack them. Been waxing lyrical about investing time and money into that shit for nigh on ever. Times like these, it'd be handy. Yet I keep putting it off, as if I've got other, more important things going on. But in all honesty, nothing is more important than the work. Yet I procrastinate from learning things that would be handy to the job. Sensitivity has made me apathetic. Knowing the deepest, darkest thoughts and the most closely guarded memories of strangers has made me hate the world around me. Hate people, all of them. Everyone seems to have something they're ashamed of, or something they should be ashamed of, that they keep locked up, deep inside. Not deep enough when someone like me is around. There are no secrets you can keep from a sensitive.